The Beat Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. This episode is specifically for healthcare professionals with an interest in inherited metabolic conditions. Asking the questions in this episode is Dr. James Nurse, a consultant paediatrician.
Hello, welcome to this metabolic podcast brought to you from Nutritia. I'm your host, James Nurse, a consultant paediatrician interested in inherited metabolic disease and medical education. Throughout this series, I'm hoping we can all learn a little bit more about the sometimes complicated, sometimes incredibly complicated world of metabolic medicine. We've already heard from dietitians, a paediatrician and a biochemist, and in today's episode, we meet another integral member of the metabolic team. I'm joined by Dr. Penny Andreou, a senior clinical psychologist in paediatric metabolic medicine. Hello, Penny.
Hi, James.
Now, Penny, there's obviously a huge role for psychologists within the field of inherited metabolic disease, but I imagine it's not something that you heard a lot about in your training. Why did you choose metabolic medicine, or would you say it chose you?
You're totally right, James. I had never heard of metabolic medicine when I first started training in clinical psychology. I would say that we probably chose each other. I've had a long-standing passion for child and paediatric clinical psychology. And I had worked in neurodisability for quite some years, working within an MDT, assessing children with a whole range of neurodevelopmental conditions. I was introduced to metabolic medicine when I was in that role, and I was really excited to hear about the diverse nature of the work, the different conditions, the role that psychology could play within that service. And so I was really interested, and sort of joined that service some years after being in neurodisability. So I'd worked in neurodisability for some years, and I was introduced to metabolic medicine, and heard about the sort of different conditions and the different nature of the work, and I was really excited to have an opportunity to join that service. So I've been really inspired by the children and families living with long-term conditions, both in neurodisability but also in metabolic medicine. I've been very fortunate to have very esteemed clinicians and allied health professionals and researchers to be working with within metabolic medicine. So, I suppose we chose each other. It's really interesting work. It's challenging at times as well, but also really rewarding. And I love working therapeutically with families and children as well. I suppose I've really had a desire to make a positive contribution to families who are living with long-term conditions. I could see that psychology and myself, I've developed lots of skills over the years. So I had a lot to offer that service.
I know certainly psychologists are very sought after within services. You're obviously really highly qualified. I've seen your CV. It's phenomenal. I'm rather ashamed by mine when I look at yours. What kind of training did you have to get to where you are now?
So I started with an undergraduate psychology and sociology degree. I had an interest in clinical psychology. But prior to clinical training, I started working as a research worker, actually, and was interviewing and assessing children and families who were part of a longitudinal study. And I think that sparked my interest and passion in developmental psychology. And kind of highlighted to me and showed me the different factors and that can impact on a child's life and development over time. And so I wanted to learn a bit more about the theory of developmental psychology. And so I did a master's degree in child development. And I've always had a passion for learning and research. So there I went to complete a PhD. And that was looking at psychological processes in ADHD. So there I was introduced to a neurodevelopmental condition, thinking about psychological processes. I mean, that was really good training and research. And that kind of set me up really for clinical training, but also beyond. So I then completed my clinical doctorate, psychology, and I got a broad range of experience working with and training with different professionals, but also working with children, adults, older adults across the age range with a range of conditions. My interest, I suppose, in neurodisability, neurodevelopment was from my PhD, but then through my clinical training, I specialised. My last training placement was in neurodevelopmental conditions. Took a job and then saw that there was a job available in the hospital that I went to, and I went into neurodisability. And there I had more clinical training working with professionals, an MDT. So working with colleagues within neurodisability, that's where I got my training on the job, if you like, with colleagues and families where children had a number of, neurodisabilities, so neurodevelopmental conditions, intellectual disability, ADHD, autism, physical health conditions, rare conditions. And so that's where I got my more practical live clinical training, if you like, and then moved into metabolic medicine. So I feel that all my training experience and clinical practice has kind of led me to where I am now. And
it's incredible how that kind of path has just, it was ongoing, and then suddenly you've found your way across into the specialty with all of that background, because obviously disability and neurodisability and ADHD and autism are all features that, well, certainly autism and neurodisability are conditions we see in our metabolic patients.
And the neurodisability, the work that I did there wasn't that much opportunity to do therapeutic work, so it's mainly assessments with recommendations, which is also really useful in metabolic medicine. But what I missed from neurodisability was the therapeutic work, which is what I'm able to do within metabolic medicine.
Obviously, psychology is so important within the service, but and when you step away from the MDT, what is it that you're doing for the patients?
It's really diverse, like I said at the beginning. I'm working directly with families, so that could be directly with a child. They may have, associated mood or anxiety difficulties in the context of their condition, maybe working with parents, perhaps to manage behaviour, or if there are difficulties adhering to a diet, could be working individually with parents who are adjusting to living with metabolic condition in their family, could be working with siblings who are also having to adjust. So that's sort of direct work. I've also developed a therapeutic group for young people with PKU and have run that twice. And so that's some group work there. Also, some children are referred for developmental or cognitive assessments. So that might be because there are educational concerns. So we'll conduct cognitive assessments, make recommendations, give advice to school to support the child's learning. Or we may conduct cognitive assessments to track development, or if there's any concerns about progression, you know, of the condition. You know, there's cognitive assessments that we might do directly. Also working indirectly, because not everybody wants to see a psychologist. Some people or some families are ambivalent about that. That can be quite common. And so could see families within a clinic. So we have psychology service within an MDT clinic, and that sort of makes us more visible as psychologists, and can be more acceptable to some people. Other times it might be more sort of providing consultation to other team members, or being part of an integrated care meeting where the MDT come together to think about the child in a holistic way. So providing sort of psychological perspective, sort of indirectly perhaps about children or families.
So you said that obviously one of the things that really attracted you to metabolic disease was this ability to do direct sort of psychological work, and then you said some people are obviously quite anxious around psychological support. These diagnoses may come as an absolute bolt from the blue from families, no warning whatsoever. For the children, they may creep up on them over time as they get older and become aware that they are not the same as other children. Obviously support, and the support you offer, is so important, but how does it actually work?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, the children and families we might see in psychology wouldn't necessarily meet criteria for a diagnosis of anything necessarily in terms of psychiatric or psychological condition. So for example, we, you know, may have a referral for a child who is not adhering to their diet, for example. So that work might be, you know, liaising with the dietitian initially, just to find out first, to get a really good understanding of what the condition is and what the diet is, and you know, what they can have, what they can't have, and how they're supported by the dietitian, and then meeting with the family. Nowadays it's more remotely, and just finding out from them, you know, what the concerns are, finding out first really about their journey to the diagnosis, how that came about, what was their experience of that. Depending on the age of the child, does the child know about their condition? What do they know? What have they been told? You know, the same with the family. What have they tried before? What has worked? What hasn't worked? Why now? You know, why is it that things are tricky at this point in time? Thinking about what might be keeping the behaviour or, you know, difficulties going at the moment. Are there any protective factors in that family or child's life that are helpful or supportive? So that's what we call, you know, developing a formulation. It's a story really about how the difficulties have arisen and why they're keeping going. So once we have that information, and it's kind of a collaborative process, so gathering information from the family and the parent and also the dietitian and the medical team, so it's quite holistic, it's not just focusing on psychological aspects. Then agreeing goals with the family, you know, with the parents, if it's in relation to their diet, setting some goals, you know, realistic goals as to what we want to achieve and in which time frame. Using psychological theory really to support that parent and the child, depending on the age again, to achieve those goals. It may be that there's often quite a lot of anxiety within the parent about the diet. So it might be that, you know, they're not having the exact amount of protein or whatever it might be that they should be having in their diet. And so there's a lot of anxiety, and there can be, without being conscious of, lots of behaviours that can keep that challenge with managing the diet.
You've obviously established these groups for young people with PKU.
Yeah.
I know that lots of our listeners will have patients with PKU. What sort of form does that take?
So we run the groups for young people, adolescents actually, so far. And they're we have three sessions and then a follow-up. So far, it's been just for young people, not parents, but that is something we're planning for the future. And the format that they've taken, I mean, we've really been guided by the young people. So the initial session is getting to know each other, a little bit of education around their condition, PKU, and then getting them to set goals. What do they want to gain from the group? And what we have found is actually the young people are asking, they're wanting to feel more confident taking their supplements in public, that's, you know, amongst their peers, but also emotion regulation. So for the older group, our adolescents who were around 14, anger management was something that came up. So the group was really geared around helping them, you know, managing supplements, taking those, and perhaps organising their day and structure of the day so that they're not forgotten as well. But also helping them with recognising emotions and feelings and what they feel like in the body, what might be going on in their minds and how they may be acting. So that's kind of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy processes. And then thinking about what they can do and how they can manage their emotions. So there may be, we've done various exercises, thinking about role play, problem solving, using mindfulness, more compassion focused strategies as well. So that's really what our groups are focused on so far. What we have found is that the young people were able to re-rate their goals, and there was definitely improvement. So they were closer to reaching their goals after the group was run. And we also used other measures as well. We asked parents to, you know, put together some goals for the group, even though they weren't attending, but their children were. And then various other measures. And we had good outcomes. So it's really positive. So we hope we can run them again, but virtually this time, probably.
You've used the term adolescence there. I think there's this awareness that adolescence continues beyond paediatric age range. Have you been able to, because I know you obviously work within a children's hospital, but the reality of our patients is they don't stop having PKU. How do you work your psychology around transition? Are you able to keep supporting them until they're in their mid-20s? What are you able to do?
They transition to an adult hospital. I'm linked up with the psychologist who works in that hospital. I know, you know, that there is continued support there. I mean, it's interesting that you asked that question, because it's only very recently that we were thinking together, myself and the adult psychologist, about running a transition therapeutic group for young people who are moving on to adult services or have just joined adult services. So that's something that we have thought and talked about.
Well, it's just it's such a formative age for young people at 18.
Yeah.
And they've got big life changes, but also big clinical changes. And if we sort of let them fall off a cliff edge at 18, I think there can be some, I know there's a lot of anxiety, especially amongst parents, about the because of the way the parent's status within their young person's care changes dramatically once they're over 18. I think that causes anxiety as well.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I know what the answer to that is, though. It's a work in progress. So that's your kind of your direct psychological role, but you've obviously mentioned there's a role in assessing patients as well. I think that the dietitians listening will be aware that there's a recommendation that children with galactosemia have fairly regular assessment throughout childhood, and there's also an assessment that children with PKU have an assessment around the transition to secondary school. What are the assessments actually, you know, look like? What does it mean we send these children off for assessments? What are you doing?
When a child is assessed, we are also asking parents as well how they're doing, how they're coping. It's not just direct assessment with the child, although that is important. But what that looks like is we would use a gold standard assessment tools for assessing IQ. So we would use the vector scales, looking at non-verbal reasoning, verbal reasoning, working memory, processing speed. So that's the gold standard cognitive IQ assessment. And then we may look at other areas of neurocognitive functioning. So we know that children with PKU, for example, may have some executive function difficulties. So we would conduct some assessments looking at that, or attention difficulties. And there are various assessments that are appropriate for looking at those areas of functioning. But we're also asking the young person, how are they coping? How's school? How are they managing? We would also liaise with school and find out how things are there, speaking to teachers. We may give a range of questionnaires as well. So, getting a full picture of how a child or a young person is functioning with their condition. And then providing a report with recommendations to support that young person. So that's, in a nutshell, what that looks like.
That's all right. I appreciate it. It's quite a complex topic that you spent years and years learning about. Yeah. So it's, one of the things you mentioned in your introduction was research and how actively you've been involved with that. Is research still a part of your day-to-day work? And it's something that's come up in our podcast before. Is it something that everyone should be doing?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. We should all be doing it. And also just to say, however small it is, I think sometimes we can feel like we need to be doing really big research projects, and that is good too. And myself and other colleagues have made grant applications and that's still a work in progress. But small projects are possible as well, even small audits. So audits are good to do as well, and also evaluating interventions, so like the PKU group that I mentioned, we've evaluated that, we've got outcomes for that.
And obviously psychology's, I see it talked about a lot online, lots of families wanting more access, lots of sort of a lack of availability. The reality of the way that inherited metabolic disease care works in the UK is it's very centralized around specific centers, but children would have to come in to see you for psychological support. Have you sort of found there are better ways to support children with psychological care with remote working, or what are you doing to sort of facilitate the needs of your patients?
Yes, we've continued to work with children and families remotely, and that's worked quite well. We'll have therapy sessions online, and some children really like that, and some prefer that as well, because they're not having to travel to the hospital and miss lots of school and travel on public transport. So that's worked really well. With regards to more direct cognitive assessments, we are still able to see families face to face for those assessments. So, and we're planning to run groups remotely, so we'll see how that works.
And I mean, as I say, it is a challenge, and there are issues around staffing and availability of people like yourself who are just adequately qualified to provide this need. Yeah. When people are planning services, looking at team structures, how can we make them aware that psychologists are an integral part of the metabolic MDT?
Ask families. You know, I think ask families, ask children, and I think they will tell you. Yeah, I think, you know, families do need to be involved in, you know, developing services, not just professionals, but also looking at, you know, if we're doing research and there are audits, looking at outcomes as well.
So I think that's, well, these are really important message that they're about having families involved in the, yeah, the development of the service structure. You're doing so much. So there's lots of incredible work. If you were to start out again on this journey, is there anything you would do differently?
When I joined metabolic medicine, I didn't really know of any other psychologists in other services across the country, and there are a few now. So I looking back, maybe making those connections a bit earlier on. I think in the last year, with more virtual meetings and remote working, it's actually made it easier to connect with other services across the country. So we have meetings, psychology meetings, with other psychologists working in metabolic medicine across the country. So we meet and think together about how we can support families who are living with a metabolic condition. So yeah, I think connecting with other services as early as possible, ways to do that.
Well, I think joined up working is so important. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and make us a bit more aware of what it is you do and how you do it, and really why you're so important within the team. I think it's been a pleasure and very insightful for me, and I hope it'll be insightful for the people listening. Thank you.
Thanks, James.
And if you're listening to this and you want to know more about the other members of the Metabolic MDT, then check out our other episodes in the series where we've already, as I mentioned, we've already spoken to a plethora of different staff members. And thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutritia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutritia, sign up to our newsletter at www.nutritia.co.uk. We'll be right back.